could be as much a ploy as a genuine initiative. Whichever it was, it got Obama off the hook. And Wolfowitz is sneaking away, see? And so I said, Paul, you ought to fess up, you know? You ought to stop lying. And just then, the CNN minder.
This week on Tell Somebody, Ray McGovern on a rapidly changing Sirius situation. Hello and welcome to Tell Somebody, www.tellsomebody.us, on Twitter, at Tell Somebody Now. This is your host, Tom Clemmer. If you have any comments or questions on the show, drop me a line at mail@tellsomebody.us. That's mail@tellsomebody.us. The podcast of last week's show with Alternative Radio's David Barsamian is now online. Go to www.tellsomebody.us and click on a tile to listen to or download that or other past shows, or you can subscribe to the podcast for free at the iTunes Store. On with the show. A couple of weeks ago, it seemed almost inevitable that President Obama would order missile and aircraft strikes on targets in Syria. Changes have developed rapidly, as reflected in Obama's revised speech Monday night. To make some sense of all this, I turned once again to former presidential daily briefer Ray McGovern. This podcast includes over 10 minutes of my conversation with Ray that had to be cut from the broadcast due to time constraints. Regular listeners know that Ray McGovern leads the Speaking Truth to Power section of Tell the Word, an expression of the Ecumenical Church of the Savior in inner city Washington, D.C. He also teaches at its Servant Leadership School. In the 1960s, Ray was an Army Infantry Intelligence Officer and then served as a CIA analyst from the administration of John F. Kennedy to that of George H.W. Bush. Ray's duties at the CIA included chairing national intelligence estimates and preparing the president's daily brief. In January 2003, Ray helped create Veteran Intelligence Professionals for Sanity, VIPS, to expose the way intelligence was being falsified to justify the war on Iraq. Ray has a website, www.raymcgovern.com. I reached Ray at his home in Arlington, Virginia, Monday, 9/11/13. Give a listen. Ray McGovern, welcome back to Tell Somebody.
Thanks for having me, Tom.
So, when I first decided to try and get you on again this week, I was thinking that a U.S. strike on Syria was just getting close to a done deal. A lot of things have happened in the last few days, and we heard Obama address the country on television last night. What was your reaction to what he had to say?
One of immense relief. You know, I think that the occasions on which we can sit back and take a deep breath and say, hey, you know, the people prevailed, those occasions are so few that we owe it to ourselves to do precisely that. When you consider that just 13 days ago, okay, on the August the 30th, if that's 13, August the 30th, Kerry got up, John Kerry, Secretary of State, although he certainly is acting as Secretary of War. He got up and, you know, with a flushed face and a really indignant tone, said, we know 35 times, okay? Now, what do we know? We know that there was a terrible attack on the suburb of Damascus on August 21, or maybe two attacks. And we know that Bashar al-Assad was responsible, okay? That we have evidence to that effect. And I'm releasing today, again, August 30th, a four-page summary. Actually, he didn't call it an intelligence summary. It's labeled a, quote, government assessment, end quote. Now, I've been in Washington 50 years, Tom, and this is a new genre, okay? In the past, the intelligence community was gotten together, and the chief of the intelligence community, the principal advisor to the President of the United States on intelligence, would bang some heads together and come up with an intelligence assessment. That's what happened with Benghazi, for example. And it would be issued in the name of the Director of National Intelligence. Not so this time. Why am I making a point of that? Well, inside, embedded on the first page of that assessment, some hardy soul insisted that the words be included to say this is not confirmed. Okay. The sentence reads, we have high confidence in our assessment, but it awaits confirmation. Whoa, awaits confirmation, okay? How can you have high confidence if you don't have confirmation? So there I smelled the rat right away, and when you looked at the text of the thing, there were no particulars, nothing that could be checked, okay? So it wasn't, you know, you didn't have to be, how do they say, you didn't have to be thoroughly distrustful to say, well, you know, we're owed better than that. Now, that was the 30th of August. Now, on the 31st of August, there were hundreds of us outside the White House protesting, shouting, no war on Syria, no war on Syria. You can actually hear us. We had some streaming from inside that we were privy to, and we were told that the president delayed his appearance in the Rose Garden because it was too noisy with all the shouts outside the White House there on Constitution Avenue.
No,
and so when he did get up before the microphones, you can hear us in the background. Anyhow, we all expect them to say, at my order, this evening, U.S. Air Force will bomb the hell out of Syria or something to that effect. No, he didn't say that. What he said was, I have the authority to make war, but I'm going to. I'm mindful of the fact that I'm president of the oldest people's democracy in this world, and so he didn't say it this way, of course. Since the Constitution says that I should consult Congress first, well, I'm going to do that. Wow, we all breathed a big sigh of relief. This was a incredible bend in what had been happening. He was going to seek congressional approval. Now, what happened between John Kerry's vitriol on the afternoon of August 30 and Saturday afternoon, the day later, when Obama got up? Well, it's clear to me, you don't have to be a rocket scientist, the new element was the president saying, as he did on Saturday afternoon, Chairman Joint Chiefs of Staff has advised me that we could do this retaliatory attack today or tomorrow or next week or next month. There's no particular urgency to it. So, wow. Now, we know that General Dempsey is from Missouri, so to speak. No offense intended. He needs to be shown, right? Because he knows what war is like. And so do all the other chiefs on the Joint Chiefs of Staff. Now, who doesn't know what war is like? Well, for instance, there's Susan Rice. There's Samantha Power, the tough gals now working for Obama. And there's a whole bevy of people who never served, who never even got close to a military base, much less served in war. And so my reading is that General Dempsey got to the president and said, look, Mr. President, we know what war is like. we know that the task that you've assigned us is pretty near impossible, to keep it limited. And so, you know, if you want to outweigh our views in favor of the tough guys and gals in the White House, you're the president, you can do that. But you might want to remember that's going to be really, really hard to justify if people later come around and say, well, why'd you have to do it so quick? Why couldn't you wait for the results of the UN inspectors? You know, why couldn't you get more support abroad or domestically? You know, why did you have to rush? So just to remind you, Mr. President, it's going to be really, really tough to answer that, because if they ask me, I'm going to have to say, well, from a military sense, there's no real rush, okay? Now, strengthening my inference there is what happened the next day. We're moving to Sunday now, okay? I guess that's the 1st of September. John McCain and Lindsey Graham come out of the White House after meeting with the president in high dudgeon. They are really, really angry. And who are they angry with? The chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, to whom they direct vitriol that you wouldn't believe. So it's pretty clear to me that the president came to his senses, said, I've been really poorly advised, once again, by these folks in the White House. And I better listen to General Dempsey, because not only will it be a military problem, he might quit. Or, you know, it just may not go down real well when they ask him why it was so urgent. So we're into Sunday, the 1st of September. Now, today is the 11th of September, a memorable day, of course. What happened in the interim? Well, in the interim, the case was so flimsy that no matter how stentorian and how insistent John Kerry was, he was persuading no one. Friends of mine said, you know, I wouldn't buy a brand new used car from this guy, you know. And so the support for the administration's case to bomb or tomahawk Syria got harder and harder to make. Don't believe me. The chairman of the House Armed Services Committee, Buck McKeon, said on the Sunday talk shows, look, you know, it's not proven, especially the notion that President Assad was personally responsible for ordering this attack. Just not proven. We're from Missouri. He didn't say that, but that's what he meant. So all of a sudden, we're in a position where not only is the president going to lose in the House, which everyone pretty much expected, but it looks like the Senate was at least 50-50, and actually some of them leaning toward voting against this thing. What happens? Well, a deus ex machina. Now, for those of your listeners who are a little fuzzy on what that means, that the literal translation is God from a machine, okay? And this refers back to the old Greek tragedies, when the protagonist got in such difficulties that it looked like there was no way out on the stage, a machine, a derrick, would come over on a rope, and he would be plucked out of the dangers by God, by Deus. Okay? So the machina was the machine. Deus ex machina is God out of a machine, and he would be plucked to safety, and would have an American-style happy ending, okay? Didn't always work that way, but that's what the expression means. Well, who's the Deus here? Who's the Deus ex machina? Would you believe Vladimir Putin?
It's surprise,
the most
surprise.
Extraordinary thing. What happened on, let's see, it was just Monday morning, I guess. Yeah, Monday morning. So we're fast-forwarding to just this past Monday morning. John Kerry is in London, and he's giving a press conference, and he's speaking from his notes. And before he leaves the hall, some reporter asks him a question that he hadn't expected. And it was, you know, a pretty decent question. Mr. Secretary, is there anything at all that Bashar al-Assad could do to avoid this strike on Syria? And Kerry said, well, yeah, he could give up all his chemical weapons to international inspection, give a full accounting of them, but that's not going to work. He's not going to do that. 10 minutes later, State Department's spokesperson says, well, yeah, of course, Kerry is just making a rhetorical statement there. They'll take that seriously, right? 2 hours later, The Soviet Foreign Minister Lavrov gets up before the cameras and says, "We are proposing to the Syrian government that they relinquish all their chemical weapons to UN inspections and then have them destroyed, and we hope that the Syrian government will reply in the affirmative." 2 hours later, the Syrian foreign minister replies in the affirmative. Now, what was Kerry thinking? Well, Kerry wants the war. He doesn't want anything like this. Did he make an honest effort to get this done? I don't think so. And you know, I think the Russians are so teed off about Kerry's attitude that they decided to mousetrap him. Putin and Obama apparently discussed this at the St. Petersburg summit. It was hardly clear that anything would come of it, but the soil had been prepared for this kind of Russian initiative, and it gave a lifeline to our poor president, who had no support outside of a few stalwarts there in the Middle East, and I guess Fiji would figure into that, into this coalition he was trying to build, and no support in the Senate or the, well, hyperbole, some support, but not enough in Congress. And so what was he going to do? Well, here was a chance to appear statesmanlike, to be able to brag that, you know, it was partly our threats for military action against Syria that turned this around. Which threats, I hope your listeners know, are illegal under international law. And under national law, the UN Charter forbids not only violent action, but the threat of action against other countries. The only time that is permitted is when you are attacked or there's an imminent danger that you would be attacked.
Let's be real clear about that. What is it, the supremacy clause? Because we've signed a treaty that, as you say, even just threatening this, much less doing it, whether or not Obama gets authorization from Congress, it's still illegal both under international law and our Constitution. Have I got that right?
That's exactly right. Yeah, they call it the Supremacy Clause. All it really says is that any treaty, international treaty, that the United States signs automatically becomes, quote, the supreme law of the land, as though, it, you know, quote, end quote, as though it was part of the Constitution itself. So people need to be aware that even though we kind of look with, well, we kind of diss or we kind of prescind from international law these days, it's on the books. And even were Congress to approve this kind of thing, which they're not going to do anytime soon, it would still be against international law, and it would still be against our Constitution, because we were not only one of the first signatories to the UN Charter, we drafted the darn thing, right? So anyhow, here Putin comes to the rescue. Now, it's a most unlikely thing, and of course, you know, as I've been telling interviewers, you have to kick the tires on this thing, you know? But, you know, if you look at the reasons behind why the Russians did this, if you have a sense of Russian history, it really helps. You know, Russia was not Russia until about the mid-18th century, and Moscow's writ did not extend very far south until Catherine the Great built up that domain. And since Catherine the Great, we're talking mid to late 18th century, Russia has always been incredibly sensitive to and protective of what is called its, quote, soft underbelly, end quote. They pay close attention to what's going on to the south, even though some of those stands, some of those little republics have broken free and become independent. Well, it's the near abroad in the Russian language, the near abroad, and they're very sensitive to that. Now, Iraq is not Syria, and Syria is not Iraq. Syria has been a longstanding sort of companion of the Soviet Union. Soviet Union and Russia. Russia has certain rights to Latakia, the base naval base there in Syria. And there are Russian experts all over the place, sophisticated Russian weaponry, which Assad is able to pay for with the oil dollars and other things that he has. So this is a different situation. Not only that, but the Russians are really sensitive to appearing as something quite less than the sole remaining superpower in the world. Putin has a visceral disgust for Kerry. Witness the fact that he's called him a liar. He usually don't do that. He doesn't much care for Obama either. So Russia is a major factor here. Russia has no love lust for Bashar al-Assad, but they've had a good relationship, and nobody wants an ostensible ally like Syria to take a real bloody nose from the, quote, sole remaining superpower in the world and appear helpless to defend them. Worse than that, nobody wants, not even the Russians, the use of chemical weapons, whether Assad used them, as the administration contends, or whether it was some other exposure, which is quite possible. So Russia is playing a big game here. With Assad, it has probably enough influence to get this through the UN. Is it going to be difficult? Of course it will be difficult. Even, you know, on the ground, how do you identify and then destroy a whole bunch of chemical weapons? I mean, we haven't been able to destroy ours, although we have treaty obligations to do so. Every 3 years, we ask for an extension, okay? So, yeah, the Washington Post is quite right in saying, oh, it's be very hard. Yeah, it's very hard. It will take a long time, but it can be done. Look, if they can take the plutonium and the uranium out of buried sites in Semipalatinsk, in what used to be the Soviet Union, and remove it and keep it out of the hands of people who shouldn't have that stuff, well, that might take 10 years, might take longer, but it can be done. So, will it be done? Well, you know, the president's going to be under an awful lot of pressure now to not trust, but verify. That's the rubric now from Lindsey Graham and John McCain. You'll remember that Ronald Reagan memorized the Russian words "Doverai, no proverai." Doverai is to trust, no proverai, but
verify. Yeah.
So McCain and Graham was saying, "Now you don't have to trust; just verify." Well, it's okay. We can verify that. Okay. Now, what's the danger here? Well, this could be as much a ploy as a genuine initiative. Whichever it was, it got Obama off the hook. And he owes Putin big time for this, okay? But let's say it's a ploy, okay? Now, let's say that the Russians and the Syrians say, wow, yeah, we're willing, we Syrians are willing to give up all our chemical weapons, but the world has to realize that this is quite unfair. Now, we have these chemical weapons because our main enemy, Israel, which occupies part of our territory, has nuclear weapons as well as chemical weapons. And so we Syrians, you know, we don't get, $3 billion a year from the United States. We don't have the money or the expertise to build nuclear weapons, but we can do chemical weapons, and they are a big deterrent. So what you're asking us to do here is to take away our deterrent and put ourselves at the mercy of Israel, which, as I say, has not only nuclear but chemical weapons, biological maybe as well. So the argument could easily gravitate toward, hey, let's do what Syria itself proposed a couple of years back and what other Middle Eastern nations have proposed. Let's get all the WMD out of the area. Man, if we got all the WMD out of the area, you wouldn't worry about Iran possibly, maybe sometime 10 years from now, getting a nuclear weapon. And the threat from Israel would create a disincentive. The threat would be removed, and there would be no incentive for Syria to have chemical weapons or anything else as a deterrent. Now, that, you talk about common sense, you know, that would make common sense. And, of course, our government is unwilling to even acknowledge that Syria has nuclear weapons.
Israel, you
know,
mean?
It was really interesting. On the NewsHour a couple of nights ago, the interviewer was shocked, you know, when she dealt with the question about Syria. Syria doesn't even... She was interviewing, actually, the Russian ambassador to the UN, and she said, Syria doesn't even acknowledge that they have chemical weapons. And Ambassador Churkin sort of chuckled, and he says, well, you know, there's another country in that area, Israel, and they have never acknowledged that they have nuclear weapons either, which, of course, was the perfect squelch, and the interviewer quickly turned the conversation to suit the different subject. The only time in recent memory where a president has been asked, you know, is there any country in the Middle East that has nuclear weapons? Was when Helen Thomas, rest her soul, gutsy Helen Thomas, asked Barack Obama at one of his first press interviews, Mr. President, do you know of any country in the Middle East that has nuclear weapons? You know what he said? Well, I don't want to speculate on that. She got a follow-up. She said, I'm not asking you to speculate. I'm just asking you, do you know that Israel has 300 to 400 nuclear weapons? So she didn't follow up, of course. And so, that, you know, the President of the United States is precluded from saying what's an obvious fact, which even the New York Times once a year on page A19 acknowledges, namely, that Israel has nuclear weapons. And, you know, sort of how this applies here is that Syria has chemical weapons. Right, they do. Now, why do they have chemical weapons? In large measure, because they feel a need for a deterrent, lest Israel decide to take still more of Syrian territory. They have occupied and actually annexed the Golan Heights, which they conquered in the war of 1967. And there's a UN resolution, Resolution 242, which says that the Israelis are supposed to relinquish those occupied territories, withdraw from them. And the Israelis have flouted that, from, I can't do the math here, since 1967. And you never see any correspondence or media types calling attention to the fact that Israel has occupied the occupied territories for longer than the Soviet Union occupied Eastern Europe, and that's a very long time. So, what I'm saying here is that there are all kinds of slips between cup and lip, depending on how adamant Assad is and how deliriously happy he is to have escaped what seemed to be in store for him. If he starts to play games, it's going to be really hard for Obama to stave off the neocons who smell blood and were really, really, really disappointed on Monday night. Let me tell you, Tom, if you have time,
yeah.
I had one of my very rare visits to CNN. They have this real fancy building right down near the Capitol, and I've been banished or sort of like ostracized from CNN domestic because I was unwilling to concede, in quotes, that Julian Assange is a terrorist and not a journalist, you understand? You know,
yeah.
I rebutted that argument pretty forcefully about 3.5 years ago, and so I don't expect to be on CNN domestic anytime soon. However, my average for CNN international is about once a year, and Monday was my chance. Okay, I'm taping something at 8:30. It's going to be shown when Europe wakes up about 4 hours later. So I get down there, and who do I see first? Newt Gingrich and his blonde wife. You know, so, you know, Washington is an interesting scene. It's probably not the same in Kansas City, but in Washington, you can never pretend that you don't know somebody that you might have met. Okay, so here I am. You know, I'm decked out in a suit and tie. Well, not a suit, at least a jacket and a tie and my khakis. And I walk up and I said, Note, how are you? And he looked at me and he says, oh, I said, Ray McGovern. He said, oh, Ray, sure, how you doing? Oh, yeah, quite a day, huh, quite a day. It was the day when Kerry did his interview there in London, in which he said, you know, that, you know, Assad could do this, and then the Russians and the Syrians had followed up and actually mousetrapped them. So I said, yeah, quite a day. So they went in there, and luckily, Tom, when you're doing these kinds of interviews, you know you're only going to have 3, 4, maybe 5 minutes, and you have about 80 minutes worth of stuff to say. Well, there were technical difficulties, and as I sat there for 7 full minutes, I had time to figure out what I needed to say. It was great. I mean, I haven't seen the tape, but I was really happy. You know, I came out of that studio really feeling happy that I had that extra time. And who do I bump into when I open the door but Paul Wolfowitz?
Oh, boy.
And I drew my right hand back. I was going to whack him one, you know, because I'm from the Bronx. And when you see a guy who's responsible for untold suffering and death, that's what you do to a guy. Like, well, no, they say, no, McGovern, no, for God's sake. Who's over there? That's Joe Lieberman. Oh, God, you know, wow.
Yeah.
Well, I decided not to deck him either, okay? So we're waiting, and we're watching Piers Morgan or all these other guys. So it was really, really quite an evening here. I'm here with these, what my Irish grandmother would call the muckety mucks, you know, the upper crust, which, by the way, she defined as a bunch of crumbs held together by a lot of dough. Anyhow, here I am in the blue room, green room, whatever it was, with these guys. And we're watching Anderson Cooper. And he has this fair and balanced bevy of people. David Gergen, Ari Fleischer. Ari being the Bush spokesman, the White House spokesman. So these guys were, you know, it was sort of like, it was bizarre. At times they were angry as could be that the Russians would give the president a lifeline so he wouldn't have to bash the Syrians as he apparently thought he had to do. So there was a lot of anger, but there was also kind of a funereal atmosphere as though, you know, this new war that they were plumping for was not going to happen anytime soon. And it was bizarre. I mean, one would expect in these circumstances, at least I would expect to say, wow, so there's a graceful way out for the president here? Trust but verify? Wow, should we not rejoice that the cruise missiles aren't going to be raining down on Damascus anytime soon? Well, there's none of that. So anyhow, I'm waiting there watching Piers Morgan then, and then after that, Lieberman and Wolfowitz show up on the screen because they're in a different studio. So I'm watching them, and Wolfowitz is asked, well, what about the intelligence before Iraq? You know, that turned out not to be so good. I went at this time, and of course Wolfowitz says, everybody believed that the intelligence, that they had weapons of mass destruction. You know, it was just kind of sickening. So then Lieberman, well, you know, the president has the authority to act to launch these strikes on Syria, but I think on balance it was probably a good idea to consult Congress. So Lieberman says, well, the president has the authority to launch these kinds of attacks, but it's far better, I think, to consult Congress. And I'm saying, wait a second, this guy was a senator, right? And he was almost the vice president of the United States. Hasn't he read Article 1, Section 8 of the Constitution? It doesn't say the president has the right to declare war, to authorize war, or to pay for war. It's the Congress. I mean, if there was something that our founders and the writers of the Constitution were adamant about, it was that, okay? So I have this little pocket Constitution, Tom. Actually, Dennis Kucinich gave it to me. Okay, so I opened it up, read, just to refresh my memory, Article 1, Section 8, tore out that page of the Constitution. And then when they finished their interview, I lurked in this very elaborate very ornate elevator waiting place. Okay, and there they come, Wolfowitz and Lieberman. Now, did this, the same Washington thing. Gentlemen, gentlemen, they like to be called gentlemen. Gentlemen, it's not such a good day for war, is it? Well, they didn't know how to take that. So I went up to Lieberman. I said, Ray McGovern. He said, oh, yes, Ray, sure, how are you? Well, I'm not so good, Senator. Did I hear you correctly? The president has the authority to start a war? Well, let's not argue about this. I'm going to give you this page out of my Constitution. I can get another copy of the Constitution. But here's Article 1, Section 8. Would you take it home and read it, please? Because I now have a completely different reading from the one you apparently have. Oh, well, I went on and on. And Wolfowitz is sneaking away, see? And so I said, Paul, you ought to fess up, you know? You ought to stop lying. And just then, the CNN minder, there's always a very attractive woman that escorts you around, and she was pulling her hair out that night because there were all kinds of things going on, and she wasn't with Wolfowitz and Lieberman when they needed her. And so she came upon the scene and said, oh, gentlemen, I'm sorry. You know, I'm sorry that this upstart has called you both liars. She said, I'm sorry. So I turned to her and I said, I'm really sorry, too. You shouldn't have these jokers anywhere near your studio. And so they both sort of slinked. they folded their tent-like Arabs and silently slunk away. Now, why do I mention all that? Well, one thing that I sort of said that attractive woman is probably going to get in the peck of trouble when Wolfowitz calls the necessary authorities and says that she didn't defend them from upstarts like me. But the whole notion of this funereal is sort of like a wake that this is the worst thing that could have happened. Plans for an attack on Syria had been put off indefinitely, and Obama was not totally disgraced. And of all people, the Russians bailed him out. Oh, God, it was just a real, real sad night at CNN. So that's kind of a long-winded thing, but I get to do that so seldom, Tom, and it's seldom so, you know, it reminded me of my little debate with Rumsfeld. This was more satisfying in a sense because Lieberman should know the Constitution, right? And that's what it was like, and right now, I think sometimes we have to rejoice, and I don't spare that word, rejoice when things like wars don't happen. People are saying, well, you think it's over? Yeah, it's over. For weeks, months, maybe forever. Even Andrea Mitchell, sadly, admitted that just after the president's speech yesterday. So, you know, as we say in the Bronx, leave us rejoice a little bit when there's an occasion to rejoice. Ain't going to be no war against Syria anytime soon. The president will still be under a lot of pressure to do precisely that. The Russians could be up to tricks, but, you know, maybe Kerry should resign. You get some forceful negotiator there that doesn't blow his blood clots there on his forehead when he speaks. And this thing can be worked out. Yeah. You know, Obama, I don't think, wanted to do this to begin with, and his military, as I read them, are dead set against it. So, you know, leave us rejoice, at least for the nonce.
Yeah, let us rejoice, and things can still go hinky, but there does seem to be at least a possible opportunity to go in a completely different direction. One of the shows in the last couple of nights had is it Charles Dilfer, the former Iraq weapons inspector, on?
Oh, Dilfer, right. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and he was talking about if it can be decided to go ahead with this idea of taking control and inventory of the chemical weapons, that it can be done. It could be problematic if any of them are in areas where civil war is still going on, but that even however long it takes to decide, yeah, let's go ahead with this, then it would take at least weeks to hammer out all the rules like they did in Iraq for what kind of access and cooperation
Sure.
And who decides where to go. And then it could take months to years to actually accomplish that. Now, that's still greatly preferred to launching a bunch of bombs, but there's a lot of places where it could go wrong along the way, isn't there?
Well, you're right, Tom, and that's why I mentioned, you know, Washington Post front pager says, oh, it's going to be awful hard. Oh, we may not be able to do this. Well, again, I think the analogy between what we were able to do when the Soviet Union imploded, and there were all kinds of nuclear materials hidden and available in Central Asia and Siberia and all kinds of places, and some senators, including Senator Nunn in our country, dealt with the Russians, Soviets at that time, well, the Russians then later, and they figured out a way to find this stuff, to cooperate in a multilateral way, not just U.S.-Russian, and to remove it. And the big testing site at Semipalatinsk in the middle of Central Asia, that seemed to be a real challenge, because they really didn't, they weren't sure where they had buried a lot of this stuff, okay? Well, they found it, and just last week I read an article saying that it had been neutralized and removed. So it's possible. Where there's a will, there's a way. Now, Tom, I would like to make a comment on how the American people are being deceived, even as we speak. What has really bothered me is the hyperbole that's been used. The important question really is twofold. Was there a chemical event outside of Damascus on 21st of August, or two events, depending on the accounts you get? Yes, there was. I mean, I don't deny that. And so the president is saying, well, who denies that? That's undeniable, okay? The only problem is that he conflates that with whodunit, okay?
Yeah.
Now, the Obama administration, you know, it keeps citing sources and methods as an excuse not to reveal the evidence, such as it may be. One piece of evidence apparently comes from an intercepted message, and it is very unclear what that message said. The administration has claimed that indicates that Bashar al-Assad not only knew about it beforehand, but ordered it and got a report, an after-action report and all that stuff. Well, hello, that's not what the German intelligence service has been saying. That's not what other reports say. They say that this intercept reflects a complete surprise and some panic. You should know headquarters in Damascus. You should know what just happened here. Who ordered that? This is awful. This is what happened. Okay? Now, what's the truth? I don't know. But, you know, after all the lies that have been told, just in recent months, the head of National Intelligence, James Clapper, asked if NSA is monitoring telephone calls of U.S. citizens, said, no, sir, a blatant lie, which he later acknowledged to be, quote, clearly erroneous, end quote.
Yeah, and I think he also said he was trying to speak in the least untruthful way he could.
That's exactly right. You know, when Andrea Mitchell, you know, tried to soften the impact of this, she said, well, how'd you do it? He said, well, they were trying to trick me, and so I gave them the least untruthful answer.
Wow.
Well, now, he's head of the intelligence establishment. Everybody reports to him, including John Brennan, the head of the CIA. John Brennan, I know him. I wouldn't trust him to walk my dog. Susan Rice. Now, she would have been a logical person to have on those Sunday talk shows last Sunday. But, you know, memories are not so fuzzy that people don't remember how she distinguished herself, so to speak, when she was asked about Benghazi less than a year ago. A little bit more than a year ago now. The September 11 attack on our diplomatic installation or, quote, mission, end quote,
yeah.
Benghazi. So it fell to this fellow as a pleasant face, McDonough, I guess is his name, Dennis McDonough, And, you know, he said, the entire world believes that there was an incident there and that Assad was responsible. Well, see, that's the way they conflate it. The entire world recognizes, including me, that there was an incident outside of Damascus on the 21st, okay? Unless you don't want to include me and my coworkers, my colleagues and veteran intelligence professionals for sanity, and Buck McKeon, who's head of the House Armed Services Committee, and several others who spoke out also on Sunday and said the evidence is not conclusive on the second part, okay, see the conflation here. Yeah, there was an incident, but we don't know who did it. The evidence is not persuasive. That's what McKeon said, and he's been shown the secret stuff, okay? So what am I saying? I'm saying that there's a way that Obama can honestly get out of this dilemma, and that is just to follow the precedent set by Ronald Reagan back in 1986, and I was there. I was on active duty, and this is what happened. On the 5th of April, 1986, there was a terrorist bombing at a discotheque in Berlin, heavily frequented by U.S. Soldiers. Two soldiers, U.S. soldiers, were killed. Scores were injured, and all told, there were 230 people badly injured. Okay, now, we had an intercept showing that this was the work of Libyan intelligence. And when President Reagan saw that, he was in high dudgeon. You know, he was really fit to be tied. And so 10 days later, on the 15th of April, 1986, he ordered, I think, 90 bombers to do their work on not only Tripoli and Gaddafi's palace, but Benghazi of recent memory, okay? So they did their deed and in the process killed Gaddafi's 15-month-old stepdaughter and his, and almost killed, wounded seriously, his three-year-old son, his youngest son, but they missed Gaddafi. Now, for those of your listeners who are, you know, don't have a touch of gray in their hair, they have to realize that before 9/11, it was not looked on favorably to be killing little children, and it certainly wasn't welcomed when the sole remaining superpower in the world sent its bombers to bomb palaces and other places in Benghazi and Tripoli. They wanted to know what the evidence was. They knew that you know, Ronald Reagan hated Gaddafi from another picture. I mean, from, as we say, the Bronx from another movie, okay? But he really hated Gaddafi. This looked very much like a pretext for Reagan to exact his vengeance on Gaddafi. So Reagan came to us in the intelligence establishment and said, look, we're going to have to release that message because, you know, I have a, you know, with the Declaration of Independence, I have a decent respect for the opinions of mankind, and the whole world thinks that, you know, I just used this as a ruse. They don't know the evidence, so release that intercepted message. And we all said, no, you can't do that. That's sources and methods. No. If we show that we can intercept and translate, decode Libyan messages like this, we'll lose a vital source. And Reagan said, to his great credit, do it anyway. And we did. Now, what was the reaction? Well, you know, there's some still like me who really don't think it's a good idea to be killing little children and bombing palaces, but for the most part, the world sort of said, oh, wow, okay, so they did have the goods on Gaddafi, and the abhorrence and the vitriol reaction that took place earlier subsided, and Reagan came out of it smelling a lot better than he would have were he to defer to the wishes of intelligence, never, ever, ever to divulge a sensitive source. Now, why do I go through all that? Well, obviously, Obama has the same flexibility. And if this interesting intercept, which the government, our government, claims shows the hand of Assad in all these things, preparing, you know, launching and after-action report on the incident on the 21st of August, if it shows that, okay, I'm prepared to believe it. If it doesn't show that, if it's much fuzzier, if they release the actual text without fudging it up like Colin Powell did to Intercepts on the 5th of February, 2003, if they release the original text, then we can see what we have. But until they do, I'm sorry. Trust me, it's not going to work with me anymore.
Yeah.
I was around for the Gulf of Tonkin. I knew there was no second incident in the Gulf, the one that LBJ used to get the resolution permitting the rest of the Vietnam War, and we're talking 64, didn't end until 9 years later. Okay, I was there. I was not the analyst for North Vietnam, but my friend was. I knew what he had, and I know that he was refused permission to publish that thing on that evening. Because why? Because the big boss said, we don't want to spoil our entree to the White House. Okay? Now, that kind of thing might be going on now. And if it is, the hope is that there are enough people with consciences who kept silent before Iraq, who saw the fraudulent nature of the intelligence, not the mistaken, but the fraudulent nature of the intelligence before Iraq, and regret to this day that they didn't speak out. Well, there are people like that now. Some of them are talking to us, and they're warning us that the fraud is afoot again, and that just as that Downing Street memo put it, when Tony Blair was briefed on what U.S. plans were, his chief of intelligence said, well, the evidence is flimsy, that we respect that, but, quote, the intelligence and facts were being fixed around the policy, period, end quote. So it's altogether possible, given this recent history, as well as Tonkin Gulf and other history, that the administration is playing fast and loose with The Intercept and the other information they have, and I won't believe the administration version until I see the evidence, and it's very, very suspicious to me that surely Obama knows that he is authorized to declassify and release that intercept. Why he doesn't? Well, I'd just say that this feeds suspicion that the evidence that they have is not anywhere near as conclusive as the fact that the incident happened. In other words, we know an incident happened, but we don't still, in my view, know who done it. And after we have a self-admitted perjurer as the Director of National Intelligence, as we have Brennan, who at one point said no civilian casualties happened in Pakistan for the drone strikes for almost a year. Yeah, right. And we have Susan Rice, whose record for credibility is severely damaged. It could be, and we leave the president this out, we veteran intelligence professionals, for sanity. It could be that they're giving the president plausible denial. Okay, what does that mean? That means that they're not telling him all the evidence that they have. They're not giving him the evidence that, for example, and this is fact, it's easy to get sarin. That little group in Japan, when they spread it in the subway at Tokyo, they had sarin. And how many years ago was that? So it's you know, it's a bum contention that, oh, you can't use sarin. Only government stocks have sarin. That's in itself a lie. So we have to kick the tires, not only on the Russian and Syrian proposal, but kick the tires still on the factual basis for saying that Assad approved this personally, because in my view, he almost certainly didn't. And I'm inclined to doubt the administration's account on several accounts, including the BND, the Bundesnachrichtendienst, the German intelligence service, which has been intercepting messages for months and has a tally of about six or seven times when subordinate commanders have asked for permission to move chemical weapons into place for use, and each time Assad has said, no, nicht, nein, don't do it, okay? So there are all kinds of contradictory things out there. The president can clarify this. If he doesn't, then my suspicions grow still stronger.
Okay. Now, Ray, we're just about out of time and probably can't address this fully as we would like, but I did want to get at least a quick reaction to some of what Obama said last night. Now, it's bad enough Joe Lieberman needs you to hand him a piece of the Constitution to understand what the president can do, but the president himself, I wish you had another copy of that page to give to him. He said,
I noticed that. He did it very briefly. He said, even though I possess the authority, he doesn't. You know, it's much more complicated than that. He's referring probably to the War Powers Act. The War Powers Act, just like the UN Charter, prohibits any such attack unless you have been attacked or you are in imminent danger of attack. Now, no one is contending that that's the case with respect to Syria, okay? So it's not only the UN Charter. It's not only just common sense that says it's an illegal thing. It's a war of aggression to attack another country when you're not in danger. Witness what we did with respect to Iraq. It's the War Powers Act itself. Everybody says, oh, that gives the president power to do it for 60 days, 90 days. And that's not true. It's got to be imminent danger or an attack that has already happened on your country.
Obama last night also evoked the specter of Iran with nuclear weapons in connection with this, which I don't frankly see the connection. Secretary Kerry also mentioned this in, I believe it was the August 30th speech you mentioned. He said one of the risks of doing nothing in response to these August 21st attack is that Iran, quote, which itself has been a victim of chemical weapons attacks, will now feel emboldened in the absence of action to obtain nuclear weapons. Now, we've heard from you several times about the National Intelligence Estimate, and I believe it was 2007, where all 16 intelligence agencies concurred that Iran had stopped trying to make a nuclear weapon.
Okay. Well, yeah, it's, you know, it's a crock. First of all, it's the old domino theory, you know. They're arguing that if we don't stop Assad from using chemical weapons, quote, again, end quote, all kinds of bad people like the guys, like those fellows in Iran, they will be, quote, emboldened, end quote, to what? Now, the president himself yesterday, to his credit, avoided saying that Iran is working on a nuclear weapon. He didn't say that. David Gregory, of course, said that on NBC News. He asked a leading question to Dennis McDonough. Don't you think that Iran's efforts, his campaign to get a nuclear weapon, might be a factor here? And McDonough said, thank you very much for mentioning Iran's attempts to get a nuclear weapon. Well, it ain't so. The intelligence estimate still stands, that they stopped working on a nuclear weapon in the fall of 2003 and have not resumed work on a nuclear weapon, okay? So this business about Iran would be emboldened, well, you know, that is a sop to the Israelis and to the neocons who really, really see the thing against Syria as being a larger struggle where Iran, Syria's ally, and these two do have a mutual defense treaty where Iran can be given a really bloody nose or shown to be something of a coward if it didn't respond to what the U.S. was being prepared to launch against Syria. So, yeah, Iran is always in the background. I see good news in the fact that the president didn't do the David Gregory thing, issue words that suggest that the president believes that Iran is working on a nuclear weapon. He was more careful than that, and that's not always been the case with Obama. So I think Obama's beginning to see who's a patriot for the United States and who not, who knows about these military matters and who doesn't. And I think that he owes Vladimir Putin big time for this initiative, and I'm hopeful that they can work it out without being sabotaged by the very people who really, really were down crestfallen and downtrodden on Monday night when they realized they weren't going to get their war.
Yeah, and it just seems to me like if I were Iran, I'd be much more inclined to restart the nuclear weapons program if the U.S. strikes Syria than if they don't.
Now, that's a common sense argument, Tom, but, you know, the issue is never framed that way here in Washington. The lobby, the Israel lobby, which really turned out full guns for this thing and is, I think, quite embarrassed at having lost this one, they're out to give Iran a bloody nose. And you know, part of this is the demographics of the thing. They depend largely on very wealthy, elderly, hardline, not all Jews in this country by any stretch, but hardline Jewish people like Sheldon Adelson, who has billions of dollars to devote to the cause. Now, these people are going to pass from the scene pretty soon, all right? How about the younger ones? They don't buy this stuff. And so Netanyahu and others are looking at this kind of time scheme and saying, you know, if we don't get Iran now, I mean, there's going to be no appetite, even on the part of AIPAC, to the degree they have you know, anybody below 80 years of age, to encourage the administration in Washington to do this kind of thing. So I'd ideally like to have it done. I think Obama is not going to be hornswoggled into that. And the best evidence of that, in my view, is General Dempsey. And let me just conclude with this. This time last year, exactly this time last year, we were all really afraid, at least I was and many of my colleagues, that Iran, that Israel was going to take off after Iran, provoke them in some kind of way so there'd be a war or at least a skirmish before the presidential election in November. It looked very clear that's what they were up to. Obama says, please don't do that, please, please. He sent Panetta, and he sent McDonough, and he sent all high-level emissaries to say, please, no, we don't want you to attack. But you know what? Netanyahu looked like he was going to do it anyway. So finally, General Dempsey goes to the president, and he says, Mr. President, this would be awful. You know, I don't want to be a Joint Chiefs Chairman that would be in any way associated with attack on Iran, and of course, if the Israelis started it, you probably would feel obliged to support them. So, let me speak out. You're unwilling to do that for political reasons. Let me speak out. And Obama says, "Oh shucks, I suppose, yeah." So Dempsey goes to London, and on the 30th of August, so just a little over a year ago, he gets up and he says, "Quote: I don't want to be complicit if the Israelis attack Iran." Period. End quote. Whoa. When I saw that, I said, well, it would have been better if the president said it. Chairman of the Joint Chiefs, that's not too shabby. And that was it. We could see that Netanyahu pulled in his horns, because now it was public. And now if they did do that, the president had a lot more flexibility not to respond in a knee-jerk way to join the war against Iran that Israel had started. So Dempsey, again, I think he's a straight shooter. I think he's an honest person and argues the military realities here. And I think that he was largely responsible for the fact that we're not bombing and strafing and missile attacking Syria right now.
Okay, well, I think we'll have to leave it at that, Ray McGovern. Thank you very much.
You're most welcome, Tom.
Former CIA analyst Ray McGovern, www.raymcgovern.com. Before we close, I bring you a public service announcement from the NSA. Be afraid. Be very afraid. Well, that's it. We're out of time. You've been listening to the podcast edition of Tell Somebody, www.tellsomebody.us. Comments or questions, send an email to mail@tellsomebody.us. You can also follow me on Twitter @TellSomebodyNow. The Tell Somebody podcast is produced and distributed by Tell Somebody and may or may not reflect the broadcast of Tell Somebody, heard on 90.1 FM KKFI in Kansas City streaming around the world at www.kkfi.org. I'll be on 90.1 FM KKFI every Thursday morning at 9, right after Democracy Now! If you haven't heard Tell Somebody before, I hope you'll listen again. Check out the podcast and the broadcast. Click on a tile at www.tellsomebody.us for a link to a past show. If you enjoyed the show and appreciated the information you got from it, please tell somebody about the podcast and the broadcast. Spread the word to your friends and contacts by word of mouth or Facebook or Twitter or email list or any other way you can think of. This is Tom Clammer. I'll see you next Thursday at 9 a.m. on Tell Somebody or anytime you like at www.tellsomebody.us.